Chapter 2. Ideological Discipline. Doctor, lawyer, teacher, scientist, psychologist, sociologist, economist, engineer, professor. What makes an individual a professional? Technical knowledge and skill come to mind immediately. But there must be more to it than that, because the worker who picks up technical knowledge and skill on the job does not get reclassified as a professional. With few exceptions, the professional is a product of the schools. The fact that off-the-job schooling is what makes the difference between the professional and the non-professional is curious, because professionals in training often complain that much of the prescribed study is irrelevant to the technical knowledge and skills they will actually need to do the job. Students feel frustrated by the numerous, quote, extra requirements they must fulfill to be allowed to work and that seem to constitute an unnecessary obstacle course. Non-professional workers who feel capable of exercising more authority at work experience the same frustration. Non-professionals with years of experience resent being bossed by inexperienced professionals who, in their work, seem to be distinguished not by any greater skill or understanding, but merely by their possession of paper credentials. Non-professionals resent the fact that their suggestions face an extra obstacle to acceptance, their non-professional source. The Wall Street Journal once reported sympathetically on the plight of disbarred lawyers. One of their examples, Donald Ziegler, was forced by economic necessity to go to work as a shipping clerk in a manufacturing plant. When he delivered mail to corporate offices where executives would be discussing a shipping problem, he yearned to join in. "But I was a nobody, just bringing the mail. It would tear the guts completely out of me." Close quote. Should we have more sympathy for this former professional than we have for any of the millions of experienced non-professionals who also suffer exclusion from the decision-making process? Workers throughout the system know the problem. Skilled workers and technicians in industry often have a better idea of what is going on, what the production problems are, and what the best solutions might be than do the company engineers and scientists who often make decisions without taking the view of workers seriously. Educational aides who perform teaching functions in the schools and legal aides who work in law offices are as skilled in many areas as teachers or lawyers, but no one is seriously interested in their views and ideas about education or law. Similarly excluded are nurses and medical technicians, and often patients themselves, who are as skilled as doctors in the performance of many diagnostic and treatment procedures, but who are usually allowed only the role of bit players while physicians stand at center stage, even though most medical situations do not require such an arrangement. This is the assessment of Martin Shapiro, a doctor who stopped to take a critical look at medical training immediately after he went through it. He discusses the situation of nurses and relates an incident that illustrates their skills. A staff physician was the only one covering the emergency room on a night when someone was brought in with acute pulmonary edema, a condition in which the lungs are filled up with fluid, usually due to weakness of the heart. The physician on duty happened to be out of the emergency department when the patient was brought in. Pulmonary edema is a medical emergency. A patient who does not receive prompt treatment can die very quickly. The nurses recognized the patient's problem instantly. They paged the physician and gave the appropriate supportive care, but they could not give the medication until the doctor came. For 10 crucial minutes, the physician did not appear, despite frantic and continued paging throughout the hospital. With the patient seated upright, tourniquets applied and oxygen flowing, the nurses could do little else. They drew up the required medication in appropriate dosages into syringes and stood poised by the patient's bedside. When the physician finally sauntered in, he gave the necessary permission for the potentially life-saving injections. The tyranny of paper credentials is also well known by countless secretaries and assistants throughout the economy who do much of their boss's work, and by other workers who are not allowed to exercise their skills independently of one or another of the workplace professionals, who seem to be identifiable mainly by their suits and their wallpaper. The system tries to entice dissatisfied non-professionals into the individual solutions of chasing paper themselves. Thus, while corporations offer to pay their employees' tuition, colleges, in turn, offer academic credit for skills acquired through work experience. Such credit puts workers on the way to obtaining the required paper. Having been granted credit for their skills, they can concentrate more on the irrelevant material. If the seemingly irrelevant material is, in fact, irrelevant, then employers would be foolish to insist on hiring people with paper credentials when they could hire equally skilled non-professionals at much lower salaries. Of course, employers are not being foolish when they insist on credentials. Professionals do something for them that skilled non-professionals cannot do. As a look at some examples will illustrate, employers can trust professionals to uphold the right outlook in their creative work. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. Continuing on with the next subsection in Chapter 2, titled The Politics of Not Getting Political. Consider the school teacher. Those who employ teachers see them as more than workers who present the official curriculum to the students. A computer or television system could make such a presentation. An important role of the schools is socialization, the promulgation of an outlook, attitudes, and values. For example, the schools prepare students for the labor force not just by teaching them arithmetic, English, history, and so on, but also by teaching them to follow instructions, adhere to a rigid time schedule, respect authority, and tolerate boredom. Lessons in this hidden curriculum are taught as much in the numerous school-student interactions not involving the official curriculum as in those interactions that do. The employer trusts the teaching professional to manage these interactions in such a way as to advance the proper values. The professional is one who can be trusted to extrapolate to new situations the ideology inherent in the official school curriculum that she teaches. As a professional, the teacher is objective when presenting the school curriculum. She doesn't take sides or get political. However, the ideology of the status quo is built into the curriculum. The professional's objectivity then boils down to not challenging the built-in ideology. It is revealing that teachers who do question the curriculum attract the attention of school administrators, while teachers who are simply incompetent at teaching it tend to be ignored. Indeed, when teachers are fired, it is rarely for not teaching well. Legitimate professional questions for teachers concern not what they should be doing politically in the classroom. The professional has an internalized willingness and ability to be directed in this area, but how best to convey the material in the official curriculum. In this alone, teachers are expected to use their creativity, and the awards of the profession go to those who do best. Consider the cop. Robots could conceivably enforce the letter of the law and keep extremely busy doing so because of the abundance of infractions that occur. However, mindless enforcement would achieve the law's goals only very crudely, if at all, and that is why law enforcers must be professionals. Professionals are hired to enforce the spirit of the law, the spirit in which the letter is written. Only the professional is trusted to sense, for example, which of the multitude of minor violations of the letter are acts of defiance against the spirit, and therefore call for a response. It may not seem very radical to say that the spirit of the law is to defend the status quo. However, the police adamantly deny playing anything but a neutral role in society. Nothing reveals better the actual partisan role of the police and the priority they give to the law's spirit over its letter than do the thousands of attitude crimes that draw punishment every day in this country. An attitude crime is behavior that violates the spirit of the law, whether or not it also violates the letter. Maintaining a discourteous or disrespectful manner when pulled over by the police, for example, is not illegal, but it can get you a traffic citation instead of a warning, because the spirit of the law says respect authority. Similarly, subservience can sometimes get you off with a warning, even though you violated the letter of the law by, say, loitering. But if you talk back to the cops, the very same loitering can lead to handcuffs and a night in jail, especially if you are black or Latino. Surely, many of the estimated 20,000 instances of police brutality in the United States each year are, quote, provoked by the suspect's less than deferential attitude. In 1980, statistics came to light in San Diego County indicating as many as 700 attitude arrests there each month. The figure included only cases in which arrestees were released hours or days later with no charge filed. The figure would have been much higher had it included arrests in which the police filed contrived charges, as well as arrests for minor violations in which the police filed additional or more serious charges because of the violator's attitude, a practice known as overbooking. One San Diegan, Edward Lawson, was repeatedly stopped, frisked, and arrested, often violently, solely because of his attitude. Lawson enjoyed walking in pretty residential areas, but as a black man with dreadlocks strolling through wealthy white neighborhoods at odd hours, he would be stopped frequently for questioning by the police. Lawson would demand to know why he was being stopped, but the cops were not interested in giving explanations. When Lawson would press his demand, he often found himself thrown in the back of a squad car with his hands manacled behind him. While Lawson's demand was not illegal, it violated the spirit of the law, which says, "Know your place." Punishment for attitude crimes is rampant today. In California alone, police in 1997 made over 85,000 arrests in which they released the arrested individuals without filing charges, mainly because of lack of evidence. An even larger number of cases were thrown out by prosecutors before trial. 61% of the individuals given the arrest and release treatment by police were minorities. From employment law to landlord-tenant law to tax law to property law, the spirit of the law is to maintain the privileges of the wealthy. Yet the letter of the law is seemingly neutral on the question. The law and its majestic equality, observed Anatole France, forbids rich and poor alike to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread. Nevertheless, those who enforce the law tend to see the wealthy as good guys and tend to be suspicious of people without property. This is not because police are inherently biased people, but because they have to take up the spirit of the law to do a professional job enforcing it. The professional's objective, quote-unquote, enforcement of the law boils down to acting in accord with no ideology other than the one built into the law. A cop who challenges the law's built-in bias in favor of the status quo would quickly attract the attention of higher-ups. But this is rarely a problem, because the law enforcement professional is tuned more to following orders than to grappling with moral questions. The police officer's legitimate professional questions concern not the nature of the social hierarchy that the law defends, but how best to enforce the law that defends it. Consider the shrink. Many mental problems originate not in diseases of the brain, but in deficiencies of society. The arduousness of living with unfulfilling work, financial insecurity, arbitrary bosses, lack of solidarity, and insufficient personal power, together with the anguish caused by racism, sexism, ageism, lookism, ableism, and all the other oppressive hierarchies that plague this society, helps explain the fact that more than 10% of the population, and not counting those with substance abuse disorders, suffer from mental or emotional problems. There are enough troubled individuals in the United States to keep busy 100,000 psychiatrists and clinical psychologists, and a much larger number of clinically trained social workers and other mental health professionals. People's mental problems often appear as deviations from social or legal norms, and therefore are problems for the status quo as well as for the deviant individuals. The problems of both would be solved if troubled individuals abided by the values of the status quo. And of course, the mainstream mental health system, more often than not, works to alter behavior in that direction. But attempting to adjust people to the unhealthy society that caused their problems in the first place may not always be the healthiest approach for either the individual or society. A simple alternative would be to help some troubled individuals bring out, clarify, and sharpen their implicit critique to strengthen them for the struggle in which they are engaged, instead of removing them from it, because the struggle can be both therapeutic for the individual and beneficial to society. But the institutions of mental health, such as hospitals that employ psychiatrists and clinical psychologists, are institutions of the status quo. They are not about to turn the troubled into troublemakers, no matter how helpful that might be. The mental health professional is someone that such an employer can trust to move confused people away from struggle with social norms and authority and toward a life in which they are, quote, well-adjusted to their place in the socioeconomic hierarchy. As professionals, psychotherapists are, quote, nonpartisan in their work. They just help ill people get better. But to declare extreme nonconformity an illness, as psychology professionals often do, is a partisan act, because of the down-on-the-victim therapeutic framework it rationalizes. Treating sick individuals is a much more politically conservative framework than is treating individuals troubled by a sick and oppressive society. Evidently, it is not the place of the clinicians to question the health of the society in which the patient must be adjusted. Their legitimate professional concern is how best to bring about the adjustment. In this alone, they are expected to use their creativity. The few who do raise questions are seen as getting political. Even though it is hard to imagine how they could get any more political than mainstream clinical psychology itself, which often practices conservative social action disguised as medical treatment. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. Continuing on in Chapter 2 with the subheading, The Expert's Opinion. As the above examples illustrate, the failure of professionals to question the politics built into their work serves the interests of those who have power in society and helps maintain the social and economic status quo. But refraining from questioning doesn't look like a political act. And so professionals give the appearance of being politically neutral in their work. Nevertheless, the public is becoming increasingly savvy about at least one way in which professionals support the system through their work. People are beginning to understand that the intellectual worker's, quote, professional judgment or expert opinion is not objective as it claims, but rather favors the interest of his or her employer. Supporting one's employer and supporting the larger system are not the same thing, but because it is basically a corporate system, each boosts the other. The public most easily recognizes the political tilt of professionals toward their employers when it is blatant. Thus, not many people today are surprised at the Johns Manville Corporation doctors whose medical findings for decades helped the asbestos producers suppress information on the deadly health hazard posed by the miracle mineral. Similarly, many people immediately question the scientific opinion of a group of distinguished physicists arguing in favor of nuclear power when it was revealed that the physicists were connected to the nuclear industry and major corporations. And today, people may be outraged, but they are no longer surprised. When an HMO medical director, a doctor in a business suit, hustles patients out of the hospital very soon after major surgery, even when common sense indicates further close monitoring. Expert witnesses in big-money court cases draw further attention to reason's eager subordination to power. Today, only the most naive observers are surprised when reputable experts from the same field contradict one another under oath. In high-stakes trials, each side can afford the best experts money can buy, and these experts often turn out to be big names in their fields. Finally, consider the university professors who have received research grants from tobacco companies to study the health effects of cigarettes. These independent medical researchers, whose names are often followed by the letters MD, PhD, are typically well-respected, highly prolific scientists at prestigious institutions such as Harvard University. Many have served on presidential or other high-level government advisory committees. For decades, these scientists have served their sponsors' interests by finding tobacco to be safe and non-addictive, and by attacking studies that find otherwise. In scientific journals, at scientific conferences, in press releases to the mass media, at congressional hearings, and as expert witnesses in court, these doctors have given their professional opinion that cigarettes are not dangerous. Their views fly in the face of estimates by public health scientists with no connection to the tobacco industry that smoking kills 1,200 people per day in the United States. In addition to their grantees, the tobacco companies also have scientists working for them directly. Over the years, a very tiny minority of these researchers have pushed behind the scenes to make public some of their findings critical of tobacco. But they typically did not push very hard and did not leak their findings to warn the public. It took a socially conscious non-professional to show what needed to be done. In 1994, a paralegal who worked for a law firm representing a tobacco company, acting under the name Mr. Butts, sent 4,000 pages of secret tobacco company documents to an anti-smoking activist. These revealing cigarette papers show how embarrassingly easy it is for a well-heeled organization to get what it wants from reputable scientists. The strategy of the tobacco companies has been to use scientists to make the dangers of cigarettes look controversial. The companies depend upon the fact that many observers hearing the word scientist naively think nonpartisan. Thus, the head for the Council for Tobacco Research, which was the major health research organization of the tobacco industry, told Congress, "We are scientists and we seek scientific truth." However, as the public has grown more aware of the need to ask for whom experts are working, the tobacco industry has found it increasingly difficult, but not yet impossible, to use its contrarian scientists to get people to think controversial when they think about research findings that implicate tobacco in disease and death. I'm reading from Disciplined Minds by Jeff Schmidt, continuing with the next subheading in Chapter 2. When does a job demand a professional? Could you or your boss write a how-to manual for your job? The most common answer to this question is yes, because most jobs can be described in unlimited detail. Consider, for example, what a secretary does when the boss scrawls a memo on a piece of paper and says, "Send this to all our salespeople in Texas." The manual might say, "Type the memo, let the boss check it, access the Salesforce database, duplicate the memo, address envelopes, stuff, seal, and mail." Any of these steps could in turn be described in much further detail as desired. Many workers, such as telemarketing salespeople or fast food order takers, have their very words prescribed. "Would you like fries with that?" Some jobs, however, involve work that can't be spelled out completely. Here, a manual would not be able to say much more than create, write a news story, draft a policy, design a product, compose an advertising jingle, draw a cartoon, tailor a lesson for a class, select a medical test, evaluate someone in need of social services, decide how to proceed in a scientific research project, and so on. Jobs with a creative element can't be completely formularized. A manual would not supply even the first word of a news story, for example. Beyond a certain point on such a job, the worker faces a blank sheet of paper, and the boss can't tell her exactly what to do. Here, employers simply expect their creative workers to act in the corporate interest. The artist drawing a picture for a cigarette ad, for example, is expected to make smoking look good in both specified and unspecified ways. Unlike employees whose actions can be prescribed in unlimited detail, these workers have to understand their employer's interests, because there are moments when that understanding is all they have to go on. Employers designate these special non-management workers professionals. Preparing to become a professional is fundamentally different from preparing to become a non-professional, because the blank sheet professional's face holds an infinity of possibilities, and there is no way to teach or even list them all. Professional training, therefore, centers around ideology, because ideology guides the subtle decisions and creative choices that the professional makes as she fills the blank sheet. The professional's work, in turn, propagates the ideology that guides it. Even those whose range of discretion is humiliatingly insignificant require the special preparation. The system apparently considers ideology to be of paramount importance. Thus, if the work of a particular occupation is in part creative, that is, if the decisions are not purely routine or rote, preparing and qualifying for that occupation will include a major ideological component involving years of post-secondary schooling, even if the creative work is a minor part of the job. This accounts for the seeming disparity between amount of preparation and authority on the job. After all the schooling I went through, they hardly let me make a difference around here. And it accounts for the seemingly irrelevant part of the schooling required to get the paper credentials that allow one to work as a professional. Despite years of student opposition, those qualifying requirements are still imposed precisely because they are not irrelevant. They get the individual used to the kind of political framework within which the skills and techniques of the profession are applied. When employers designate certain jobs professional and insist that employees have professional training, not just the technical skills that seem sufficient to do the work, they must have more in mind than efficiency. Hierarchical organizations need professionals because through professionals, those at the top control the political content of what is produced. And because professionals contribute to the boss's control of the workforce itself, it is crucial for the functioning and survival of the institution and the hierarchical system of production as a whole that employees who make decisions do so in the interest of the employer. As we will see, the employer's control of the political content of the professional's creative work is assured by the ideological discipline developed during professional training. And the employer's control of the workforce is maintained in part through the professional's elitism and support for hierarchy in the workplace. The preparation process develops, and the qualification process measures the student's willingness and ability to accept ideological direction from future employers. The one who has met the requirements, the qualified professional, can be trusted to do what is politically correct when making decisions and creative choices at work. Work is an inherently political activity, but professionals and non-professionals advance their employers' interests in different ways. Professionals sell to their employers, more than their ordinary labor power, their ability to carry out instructions. They also sell their ideological labor power, their ability to extend those instructions to new situations. It is this sale that distinguishes them from non-professionals, who sell only their ordinary labor power. Those in charge can trust professionals to make some decisions that must be made ideologically. Non-professionals are trusted to make only decisions that can be made mechanically. Professionals implement their employers' attitudes as well as their employers' lists of instructions. Non-professionals are only required to implement the instructions. Non-professionals often feel that their employers treat them like unthinking machines, and they long for the more human treatment that they see their professional co-workers receiving. The double standard is inexcusable, but its origin should be no mystery. The root of the boss's bimodal behavior is structural. In the professional-nonprofessional division of labor, nonprofessionals play a role analogous to that of a machine. Machines are dead in the sense that they add to the product no more value than that of the labor that went into building them. In the language of economics, they produce no surplus value or profit. Machines increase productivity, but in a competitive industry, they ultimately lead to lower prices rather than higher profits. The first companies to mechanize see higher profits until mechanization in the rest of the industry forces prices down. Unlike machines, humans, whether professionals or non-professionals, add to the product more value than they cost to employ. However, non-professionals yield only the ideological work that went into formulating the instructions they follow. Thus, just as machines are dead as compared to human workers, non-professionals are dead as compared to professionals in terms of doing ideological work. Non-professionals do not extend their employees' ideologies through their work because they do not make ideology-based decisions for their employers, so the bosses care less about what they think. Ideological workers are more expensive than non-ideological workers because they require a greater amount of formal education. The same economic forces that drive employers to replace non-professionals with machines, which initially bring higher profits, also drive them to reduce the discretion of professionals by standardizing the work procedure, or even by introducing expert computer systems. In each workplace, the bosses push for more and more detailed job descriptions and work guidelines, which transforms the employee's decision-making into a routine or rote activity and tend to strip the work result of any imprint of the employee's own thinking. In fact, non-professionals are often forbidden to be creative in their work. In many jobs, the more closely the employees follow set workplace procedures and any special instructions for the tasks at hand, the happier the bosses are. Non-professionals know that they risk getting into trouble when they innovate to get the job done. Professionals, on the other hand, are required to be creative in their work, but within strict political limits. Their creativity must serve their employer's interests, which often are not the same as their own interests, the interests of clients or customers or the public interest. Thus, the corporate PR specialist assigned to field questions about pollution, defective products, the treatment of employees, and other sensitive issues creatively uses the truth to paint a pro-company picture. And managed care doctors never forget for whom they are working either. One such doctor, for example, saves his employer $200 by withholding the antiviral drug acyclovir for adult chickenpox patients. Without the drug, the severity of the disease and the amount of permanent scarring are greater, but the chance of secondary pneumonia or death increases only slightly. Complications would be costly to the medical care corporation, but the savvy MD intuits correctly that it doesn't make economic sense for the firm to spend so much to insure against them. Employers don't have time to decide every minor issue that affects their political or economic interests, and so they seek to hire others who will do things as if they had done them themselves. Thus, professionals control the technical means but not the social goals of their creative work. The professional's lack of control over the political content of his or her creative work is the hidden root of much career dissatisfaction. To say that professionals are ideological workers is not to say they have to formulate the ideologies in the first place, for they do not. Professionals have no more control over the ideology they propagate than non-professionals have over the design of the products they produce. Professionals merely have an operational grasp of the ideology inherent in their occupation's actual role in society. Employers trust them to use that ideology to extrapolate policy and handle new problems as they arise, and to do so without constant supervision. Professionals are licensed to think on the job, but they are obedient thinkers. All professional work is in part creative. However, individuals are selected to do professional work not because they are more creative than others, but because they can be trusted to make sure every detail of what they create is politically correct from their employer's points of view. As human beings, professionals are not more creative than non-professionals. In fact, professional training tends to kill off natural creativity. In the corporate headquarters building, you can often find more creativity down in the mailroom than upstairs in the office of a lawyer, systems engineer, or financial analyst. But it is untamed. Employers will hire the dull but politically disciplined individuals over those displaying any amount of politically undisciplined creativity. Just as professionals engage in playpen creativity, innovating within the safe confines of an assigned ideology, so too they engage in playpen critical thinking. Their work involves judging whether or not the ideas of others are in line with the favored outlook, but does not involve developing their own independent point of view. Hence, professionals tend to be what might be called book review critical, which is intellectually and politically safe because it doesn't involve developing or taking a stand for an independent outlook. Professionals generally avoid the risk inherent in real critical thinking and cannot properly be called critical thinkers. They are simply ideologically disciplined thinkers. Real critical thinking means uncovering and questioning social, political, and moral assumptions, applying and refining a personally developed worldview, and calling for action that advances a personally created agenda, an approach that backs away from any of these three components lacks the critical spirit. Ideologically disciplined thinkers, especially the more gung-ho ones, often give the appearance of being critical thinkers as they go around deftly applying the official ideology and confidently reporting their judgments. The fact that professionals are usually more well-informed than non-professionals contributes to the illusion that they are critical thinkers. Professionals look beneath the surface of their technical work and see a world of contending social forces. Where the non-professional might see only technical details, the professional sees sides of debates being supported, points of view being advanced, and interests being served. Professionals are extremely sensitive to the underlying issues, and little subtext slips by them unnoticed. But professionals do more than read between the lines. They write between them as well. Like non-professionals, professionals spend the bulk of their time doing tedious detail work. However, unlike non-professionals, they are expected to make sure that the subtext of each and every detail of their work advances the right interests, or skewers the disfavored ones. If God is in the details, as the phrase often attributed to architect Ludwig Mies van der Rohe has it, then making sure the details represent the right God is the raison d'etre of professionals. Their assignments typically involve decisions on hundreds of details, and so professionals can't relax their political guard even for a moment. If tedious detail work is mind-numbing for the non-professional, It's grueling for the professional. Many people naively think of professionals as non-professionals who possess additional technical knowledge or technical skills. Professionals do exercise technical skills, of course, but it is their use of political skills that distinguishes them from non-professionals. The product of professional labor is political. It takes sides. The accountant's bookkeeping decision, the journalist's angle on a story, the lawyer's choice of contract language, the historian's depiction of events, the scientist's narrow focus, the minister's sermon, the teacher's lesson, the welfare worker's determination, the comedian's joke. Routine professional work tilts one way or the other, and the way it tilts is never an accident. Non-professionals in the workplace often discover the hard way this all-important political component of professional work. In the most common scenario, a seemingly simple problem comes up and a non-professional takes the initiative and does what seems reasonable. But non-professionals are often oblivious to the forces that are contending beneath the surface of the work, and so their decisions may advance the wrong interests, wrong from their employer's points of view. When this happens, they find their initiative rewarded with a bawling out from the boss. Next time, wait and ask somebody what to do. Somebody, of course, doesn't mean a fellow non-professional. Perhaps no one draws more attention to the political component of professional work than does the lawyer. All professionals give highest priority to making sure the right interests are served. Most professionals do this political work quietly, as they much more visibly exercise technical skills that the public sees as non-political, treating illness, informing readers, catching criminals, teaching children how to add and subtract, doing scientific research, developing new technology, designing whatever. For lawyers, however, the perception is reversed, because watching out for the right interests is not only their highest priority, but also an unusually large part of what they do. Lawyers exercise the professional's basic ability to sense interests, but unlike other professionals, they exercise no other skill more prominently. Indeed, lawyering involves such a high ratio of political work to technical work that technical knowledge is something of an afterthought in the training of lawyers. Yes, law schools do organize instruction around memorizing and applying specific principles of law, but this is done primarily as an exercise to teach proficiency at adopting and working within assigned ideologies. As Talbert D'Alembert, former president of the American Bar Association and a critic of legal education, told me, "In law school, the law is just a vehicle to teach a way of thinking." Perhaps the most obvious evidence of this is that students fresh out of law school, even those graduating at the top of their classes, do not feel they have the technical knowledge necessary to pass the bar examination. They must spend a couple of $1,000s to take an intensive 6 to 8 week bar review course to learn what they need to know to pass the test and get their permit to practice law. Ironically, the more elite the law school, the more necessary the bar review, because the professors at elite institutions emphasize ideological skills. In their words, notes D'Alembert, "We don't train you to be a lawyer, but only to think like a lawyer." Getting the student to think like a professional is the top priority in all professional training programs. And so, technical skills are of secondary importance, not just in law school. Nonetheless, the graduate psychology student, for example, learns more than how to think like a psychologist, and the graduate history student emerges knowing more than how to think like an historian. This emphasis on ideological skills in law school is precisely what the powerful corporate law firms want, because the high-stakes legal battles they fight, defending big business and wealthy clients are paramountly political. The simple ability to recite the law does not qualify one to do this work. Representing powerful clients requires lawyers who can make creative arguments about the intent of the law, who can find ways to argue that the public interest would be served by a favorable ruling, and who can sway public opinion in high-profile cases where this opinion influences the outcome. Settling losing cases out of court is political work, too. Lawyers for the powerful must know, for example, to give high priority to negotiating clauses that keep the terms of the settlement secret. This to protect the corporation's or rich person's public image and to avoid setting a precedent that would help other wrong parties to obtain justice. Thus, the big law firms aren't primarily interested in the technical skills of the law school graduates they hire. These skills are easily picked up on the job. An ideologically disciplined mind is not. Similarly, the firms don't care much about bar exam scores. In fact, the large firms typically hire law school graduates before they even take the bar exam. Lawyers have a negative public image because, unlike other professionals, they don't exercise socially redeeming technical skills. For this reason, they are seen as people who take without giving, a non-productive element of society. Lawyers themselves, especially those at the big firms, make little pretense of doing work that benefits the public at large. Thus, more than other professionals, they feel the need to reserve some of their time to work pro bono publico, for the public good. Most social workers, teachers, journalists, sociologists, scientists, and other professionals would feel insulted if you asked them whether they set aside any working time to help make the world a better place. In the words of Judge Lawrence H. Silberman of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, lawyers really see pro bono services as a penance they pay for serving a capitalist system. Perhaps the most widely distributed between-the-lines writing is the handiwork of journalists. The news stories they write for the front page of your daily newspaper are chock-full of subtext. This becomes clear when different reporters describe the same event, because then their descriptions differ in substance only by what they have written between the lines. On March 1, 1993, for example, the lead stories in both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal covered the same topic. What had been learned about the World Trade Center bombing, which had occurred 3 days earlier? The article in the Times began with these words: "The bomb that devastated the garage under the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan on Friday apparently was ... The article in the Journal began like this: "The bomb blast that drilled a four-story hole in a primary symbol of American commerce was ... Clearly, the words in the Times played down the effect of the bomb. It destroyed a garage. Why was the destruction of a garage the top news story in the world 3 days after it happened? The Journal answers that question up front. What the Times and the Journal reporters wrote between the lines here was no accident, but adhered closely to each paper's editorial outlook, and in each case, that outlook is just what one would expect. The Times is written for a readership of professionals who need ideological direction and reassurance of the system's strength. The Journal is written for bosses, business owners, and executives who give direction and do not need to be reminded where their interests lie. Among Journal subscribers, managers outnumber professionals more than 3-1. Among Times readers, professionals outnumber managers 3-2. Let's look at another example of writing between the lines, again from the front page of the New York Times. This is the lead sentence of a news report on a 4th of July 1992 parade of tall ships. Quote, majestic in a gray morning mist. The world's largest gathering of tall ships in this century sailed out of the past and up the great amphitheater of New York Harbor yesterday in a stately salute to Independence Day and the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus' voyage of discovery to the New World. The reporter's attempt here to write between the lines is rather transparent, despite his flowery language. The phrase that stands out a bit more than it's supposed to is, of course, a voyage of discovery. This clever formulation is modest enough to pass political scrutiny, yet still manages to conjure up the old elementary school textbook image of Christopher Columbus as the discoverer of America, a European rather than a Native American image. Having planted this point of view in the mind of the reader, the Time story then seems perfectly reasonable as it goes ahead and celebrates Columbus in the old-fashioned way, without reservation. It is hard to imagine a non-professional coming up with a devious phrase like this, or even wanting to.